Hey, listeners, it's your host, Daisha. So the episode that you're about to hear with members of the Cypress String Quartet is the first and last time you're going to hear the Cypress String Quartet on the Classical Classroom because they done broke up. They actually broke up way back in June. It was an amicable split, don't worry. But this episode that you're about to hear was actually recorded just 3 days prior to their final concert together. And the episode that you're about to hear is in honor of the five-month anniversary of their breakup. Okay, that's just not true. Actually, it's just because this was the first chance that we had to fit it into our busy Classical Classroom schedule. Anyway, we hope that you enjoy the episode. The content is timeless because Beethoven. And don't forget to rate and review us on iTunes because darn it if it isn't the right thing to do. By the way, speaking of right things to do, we just had an election here in the U.S., and in light of that, I just wanted to say, in the immortal words of Bill S. Preston Esquire and Ted Theodore Logan, be excellent to each other. All right, enjoy the episode. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today are two members of the Cypress String Quartet, violinist Tom Stone and cellist Jennifer Kletzel. The San Francisco-based quartet has spent almost 20 years together on stage, and during that time, they've played all over the world. They've recorded over 15 albums together, some of them at Skywalker Sound, which I can't wait to talk about. They've even been heard on House of Cards. Tom and Jennifer, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you, Daisha.
Hi, Daisha.
So it's my understanding that not only is this new album, the Early String Quartets, your last recording together, but your last concert together is this month. Mm-hmm. And yet you all look so smiley on the CD cover.
Well, we have a great job, you know, so we're really enjoying playing together.
Yeah.
And we've been together as a quartet for 20 years now, and three of us are founding members. So that means that three of us have been with the group for that entire time. Our violist joined us 15 years ago. So, you know, the four of us have been playing together for 15 years as a group. We love playing together.
So, hence the smiles.
Great experience.
Yeah. So, well, before we get to, I want to ask you a lot more about that later. But before we get into sort of the life cycle of the string quartet, let's talk about the music on your new CD. You have, I looked at your discography, and you've spent a lot of time as a quartet with Beethoven. Can you tell me why?
Actually, I would blame Beethoven for us being in a string quartet in a way. It's Beethoven's fault. No, it's when we came together 20 years ago, one of the main things we wanted to do was look at these works by Beethoven. So Beethoven wrote 16 works for string quartet, and they fall into these, you know, periods of time that people call the early, middle, and late, just because that's where in his lifetime he was writing them, but also there are specific styles associated with those. But actually, when we started 20 years ago, we dove right into the late quartets. Those are the most personal, the most spiritual. You know, the last 3 years of his life, he spent only writing string quartets.
Wow, so and you started there.
We started there. And people said, you're crazy. Why are you starting there at the end? And we said, well, we've been waiting our whole lives. You know, here we were 20, whatever. We've been waiting our whole lives to play this music. And to be able to play with a group who rehearses together every day, then you really create, you know, a world of this is the way we believe this should sound. Here's how it feels to us. And it's very different than just sitting down and reading through music with, you know, anyone who comes along.
Yeah. Yeah. So you just jumped into the deep end of the pool and you were like,
exactly.
Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how you learn to swim.
Is there a piece that you guys would like to hear a bit of from that?
Sure.
Scene?
How about there's a quartet opus 130.
Okay.
And the either last track or second to last track is called The Fugue.
the fugue.
Okay. I really like how this piece just starts right out of the gate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just arresting.
Just wait. It's about to get really interesting.
Nice. Wow. So it sounds that sounds like galloping.
Yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah, that rhythm just sounds like you're galloping towards
and it's something. And it's relentless.
Yeah.
I mean, that's Beethoven at his most, you know, he gets really obsessed with things. And that, for like 2 minutes of music, it's marked, you know, fortissimo. So at the top volume.
As loudly as you can play.
As loud as you can play. And then, because it's Beethoven and he's going to totally play with your expectations, just when you're about to turn off the recording because you're like, I can't handle being screamed at anymore, he gives you the most tender pianissimo music.
Just for, gentle.
Gentle for like 1 minute. And then it moves into this very kind of glorious, grand, almost like, you know, Handel's Messiah kind of music. And that's Beethoven. And in a nutshell, you know, what gets me so excited about this composer is what he does. And, you know, when you don't, I mean, I know this music and it still gets me all fired up, right? because it's the way he plays with the expectations that you have as a listener.
Yeah.
It's almost like he teaches you something. Okay, I'm gonna play this relentless rhythm and now you're going to get used to it. But no, you're not. I'm pulling the rug out.
Yeah, he doesn't let you rest or doesn't give you very long periods.
You
to
never
rest.
Get very comfortable.
So what distinguishes, I mean, I know just a little bit about Beethoven and that, especially toward the end of his life, in his late period, he was particularly, his music was known for its like bombast and just being really big and loud. And I know that some people have sort of posited that was because it was really hard for him to hear. And so he liked it loud. But so what distinguishes that late period that we just heard a sample of from his early period, which is on the new CD?
Well, I guess the way I would explain it is that at the end of Beethoven's life, in this late period, he was completely deaf. He had proven that he was one of the greatest composers, not only of his time, but of all time. Mm-hmm. And he really had nothing left to prove. Yeah. He was really trying to write music for history, for us today. Mm-hmm. And in Beethoven's early period, in these Opus 18 quartets that we're releasing now, he was already 30 years old, so he was a mature composer by the standards of that time. But he still had to prove that he was worthy of the classical tradition of Haydn and Mozart, who'd come before him.
Mm-hmm.
So those quartets, you hear, you know, it's kind of, in a way, it's a proving ground. Like, you hear Beethoven's personality and voice and some of the bombast and theatricality and drama that comes out in these early quartets. But you also hear him carrying the torch of Haydn and Mozart, like the lightness and operatic qualities of Mozart,
mm-hmm.
the kind of conversational musical style that Haydn had invented. He's carrying those and showing that he can do that too, and that he's worthy of this tradition.
Yeah. So it's almost taking a really unruly student and putting them in a classroom and saying, you have to behave this way. So it's a little bit of that going on, uh-huh. right? He is staying within the structures, although already he's starting to bust out a little because he's Beethoven. Right. He doesn't like the rules. He's going to change the rules. This is why we call him the revolutionary, right?
Yeah.
Because he just decided, no, I don't like that. I'm going to change that up. I'm going to, do this with harmony. I'm going to do this with rhythm.
And what to me is so cool about Beethoven as a human being and not just a composer is that he never stood still. His music mm-hmm. just always changed. And it connected to what was happening in his personal life, really. So during these early quartets, he was losing his hearing. He was 30. And, he was really disturbed about it. But he had a huge emotional crisis around 1802, where he finally came to terms with the fact that he was going to go deaf. He was depressed. He contemplated suicide. And when he came out of that depression, he had a new resolve and also a new freedom to write music. And that new freedom led to him really ushering in the Romantic era in music and identifying with figures like Ulysses from the Odyssey. Uh-huh. And you see a huge shift in his music. There are germs of it in the early quartets. You hear where he's heading, but there was a big sort of ground shift at that moment.
Yeah.
And you can sort of see those moments throughout Beethoven's life. And, how incredible for a composer to overcome deafness and still not only write music, but write even greater music than he had before.
And is it that moment, like when he sort of emerges from that depression, that you start getting the just intense emotion that people are so accustomed to?
Well, that's the interesting thing is that you hear the germs of it in the early quartets.
Yeah.
So, for example, the very first quartet he published, the slow movement is based on the tomb scene of Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's never been a more, emotionally impactful story than that tomb scene from mm-hmm. Shakespeare. And Beethoven captures it exquisitely in the music. I mean, it's so romantic and emotional. But then there was a transition after this personal crisis where those emotional germs that you already see in the early works get expanded and changed and become even more bold.
I see. It's much more restrained.
Yes.
It's lovely. It's melancholy. And it's filled with emotion, but it's much more restrained.
Yeah.
At this point, there'll be a point later on in the movement where it actually, you can even, the way that scene plays out after Juliet realizes that Romeo has poisoned himself and is laying there dead, she takes his dagger and stabs herself. That's how the scene plays out. Beethoven actually, he doesn't notate this is exactly where it happens, but there's a point where there's almost like a stab and a scream in the first violin part.
Whoa.
And then a silence. And, he really plays this out beautifully, dramatically. And it goes back and forth between the cello and the first violin as if those are, there's the Romeo and Juliet voices. So it's kind of brilliantly, it's kind of programmatic music already. He's making a scene out of it. And if you didn't know that, it's great music regardless, but knowing it, it makes it even more special.
So programmatic music, for our listeners who aren't super familiar with that term, is music that's actually kind of has a story to it, or is maybe based on some characters, as opposed to like absolute music, right? Which is
that's right.
Just self-referential music.
That's right.
Is that, am I getting it?
That's
right?
A great explanation.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah.
Awesome. Yay, I learned something. Yeah. So is that, speaking of that, like, is Beethoven more known for programmatic music or for more absolute music?
Mm. You know, I think he kind of opened the door on that discussion in a way, because they're movements like you just heard mm-hmm. that we know for a fact are based on a story, and he's actually depicting the exact story in the music.
Yeah.
There's other music that he wrote that's just more sort of abstract and sort of purely just the music.
Yeah.
And he sort of set the stage, and about a generation later, it sort of played out with composers like Johannes Brahms and Wagner and Berlioz and others,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, there were big arguments in musical journals and magazines and in the public about, you know, which approach was the right approach.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is both are.
But, right. The right approach. That's
yeah,
funny.
So.
Yeah. Well, I purposefully kind of skipped over the middle period mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I thought that it would be interesting to see the contrast of something late yeah. and then something that's early. Great. But is there anything from, I know you guys have also done the middle period. Is there anything from that that you feel like is a good example of,
yeah.
I'm sure it all is, but something
yeah, well,
that you particularly like?
Probably my favorite middle quartet is what's called the Opus 59 number 2.
Uh-huh.
And in the slow movement of that quartet, he talks about how he was reading Immanuel Kant, and there was an idea in his philosophy that Beethoven quoted, which is that the two things that never cease to amaze me are the heavens above me and the moral law within me.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea. Beethoven was trying to understand the universal and the moral, and he tries to represent it in his music.
Yeah.
What's amazing about the middle quartets is, you know, Beethoven really came into his own, and he established that he was one of the greatest composers of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And every movement's different from every other.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can listen on your own sometime and just notice that each one's unique and different.
Actually, I had a friend do that with the Razumovsky quartets. I said, okay, write a descriptive word about each movement of these three quartets.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't know anything about music, but they were amazed when they thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this one is lighthearted. Oh, this one sounds like, you know, somebody's pulling my heart out, you know, with a spoon. This one
right.
feels more like, and each one was so unique that they were amazed by that. And I said, well, that's why I love Beethoven so much.
Before you guys go, I just wanted to ask about the elephant in the room, which is that
sure.
you guys are breaking up. So who's mm-hmm. the Yoko?
We all are.
We're all the Yoko.
Yeah.
What
signaled that it was time to Cyprus out?
Well, we finished some projects that were really important to us, like recording of the early Beethoven quartets, and have had an amazing 20-year run together, and just decided it was time to try something new. And
yeah.
very few people get to work for 20 years with three other, you know, people. And I find like all of my colleagues are amazing.
Yeah.
And it's been such a privilege, and it's time to try something different now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, congratulations on an amazing career and, you know, spending that long with other human beings and having a successful go of it. That's incredible. And
oh, thank you.
I really appreciate you both being here today, Tom Stone and Jennifer Klutzel of the Cyprus String Quartet. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to HoustonPublicMedia.org/classroom. Find all of our social media links on that webpage. You can email me at dclay@HoustonPublicMedia.org. You can subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes. And you should, frankly. Thanks to audio producer Todd Middle Period Holslander for making us sound good. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing weirdo eyes. Thanks to Tom Stone and Jennifer Kletzel for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. And thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time. I can't talk today.